Call the next case. You may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, associate members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Glenn Silver, the law firm Silver & Brown. I'm appearing for Heather Graham, the defendant in the case below. Before I begin my argument, I respectfully reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I would also preserve and ask that you consider all arguments contained in my briefs.
How many minutes you want to preserve?
3 minutes, please.
Three. All right, go ahead.
I'd also ask that you consider all arguments contained in my briefs, irrespective of whether I have the opportunity to argue them this morning. For the purpose of clarification, when I refer to the underlying case, I'm referring to the first case brought by Community Management Corporation against Heather Graham for breach of an employment agreement, which was later amended to include a breach of a separate confidentiality agreement, which is contained the prevailing party attorney fee provision that is under discussion this morning. The underlying case resulted in a finding by a jury that Heather Graham had not breached either of the agreements, neither the employment agreement nor the confidentiality agreement. After post-trial motions were denied and after 21 days had elapsed following entry of the final order and all appeal periods had gone by, and after a lapse of several months, Heather Graham for the first time requested CMC to pay her the attorney's fees she had incurred in defending the underlying action. When they refused to do so, she declared them in breach and default of the confidentiality agreement and filed the present action. The complaint was thereafter dismissed on plea in bar, premised on Supreme Court Rule 3:25C, which the court construed as having constituted a waiver when no claim for attorney's fees or demand for attorney's fees was made by Graham in the underlying action. We respectfully disagree with that opinion and ask this court to reverse it.
Well, the trial court actually didn't originate that. We did. It's subsection C of 325. The failure of a party to file a demand as required by this rule constitutes a waiver. So it seems to me that your quarrel is with us, not with the trial court.
I think I'm not in the unenviable position of agreeing with you on that.
Well, what is it about the rule that keeps us from making such a rule?
I think, and I've argued this at length, under 8.01.230, you have a statute that tells you when a cause of action accrues. In this case, we have a one-sided confidentiality agreement, which could only be breached by Heather Graham, which gave her no rights, so that CMC, the appellant in this case, claimed that Heather Graham breached the confidentiality by giving out their secret information, and therefore they had a claim and a cause of action, but she had nothing she could go back on them for, because it was one-sided. There was nothing they could do that could be a breach of the contract at that time. So that left her in a position of what does she do with what I think is nothing more than a damage provision in a contract.
What about the language in the confidentiality agreement which says that in the event that an action is brought for relief under the provision of this paragraph, the prevailing party shall be entitled to an award of attorney's fees?
She had no choice. She did not bring the action. They did.
Yeah, but what if she prevailed?
If they prevail, the way this rule is written, it actually creates a compulsory counterclaim, whether you want to call it that or not. It says you have to put into your response pleadings this claim for attorney's fees, or you can do it in a counterclaim. We do not have compulsory counterclaims in Virginia. This court has rejected that each time it's been brought up.
But the issue is not accrual. The issue is whether it's a pleading point. It's just a simple pleading point and a timing of pleadings.
This court has ruled time and time again that you cannot plead something unless you have a factual legal basis for doing so.
But if that logic standing alone were true, that would mean that The plaintiff can't do it because the plaintiff doesn't know he or she or it's going to win the case at the end of the case and thus be entitled to prevailing party fees. It only accrues, as you point out, when they actually do become a prevailing party. But yet the plaintiff has to file the disclosure.
The plaintiff can claim that they believe there's been a breach of the contract, therefore they have the factual and legal basis for claiming the prevailing party attorney's fees, which is then taken up by the court at the end of the case. That is not necessarily true for a defendant. In this case, it
could be. Therefore, the rule requires the claim, the attorney's fee request, to be pled prior to its technical accrual.
I think...
Is that true or false?
False.
So how is it accrued at the beginning of the case?
It's true for the defendant. It's false for the plaintiff.
Oh. Okay.
The plaintiff can anticipate that they're going to win the case, or they wouldn't have brought the case.
Why can't the defendant anticipate that the plaintiff is going to lose the case?
Or they wouldn't have filed grounds of defense.
Because they can't put in their grounds of defense, we think they're going to lose, and therefore we're going to claim
that's
the attorney.
Back in the old days, when I said that.
Excuse me?
Back in the old days, when I was a lawyer, we always said, I am going to win. You don't deserve any money from my client.
Well,
that's why I filed the grounds of defense.
I don't necessarily agree with you. In fact, in this case, because what they were trying to prove was a breach of a confidentiality agreement, they gave out something secret, and they had this letter saying this is what the EBITDA for the company was
when you
this
answered,
year.
Didn't you think your client was going to prevail?
No.
You did not. Oh, you thought she was going to lose.
I was hoping that she was going to win, but I had to consider that the way the contract was written.
But if she did prevail.
There was a chance that she was going to lose. But here's the conundrum that I was in, is that we didn't believe that Community Management Corporation was the right party in interest. And we filed the plea and bar based on that because...
Which would cause you to win. They're not even a party to this contract, Your Honor.
Well, no. If they weren't a party to the contract, then the contract couldn't be sued upon. So we didn't have any relief that way either.
So you say if they're not a party to the contract, I win, and if they are a party to the contract, I still win, and I get my fees.
If they weren't a part of the contract, then the prevailing party attorney fee provision wouldn't exist because that contract would be out of the case.
Right.
The employment agreement, which the reason they brought it, the employment agreement itself did not have an attorney fee provision in it. It was only the 7-year-old, a 7-year-old confidentiality agreement that was done way back when she was
But the problem I'm having is your response to Justice Goodwin's question backs you into the approbate-reprobate problem because you came into the first case and said, this contract does not apply to either one of us. I have no duties, I have no liabilities under this contract. And the very argument you're making now is that you have a right under the same contract to get attorney's fees.
The approbate-reprobate issue, which was raised by the appellee in the case, I think it's handled by the case of Colello versus Geographic Services, Inc., 2012 at 283 Virginia 56, where this court in the headnotes 9 and 10 make it clear that what we have here, we didn't say that there was a problem, we didn't say that the contract didn't exist. We didn't say...
It was unenforceable as to your client.
No.
Because your client was not a party to a contract with the plaintiff.
The plaintiff was not a part of that contract either. That's what we said.
Well, okay.
Because the contract was between Associated Inc., a Texas corporation, which didn't exist, and its affiliates. The court decided that Associated Inc., which was close enough to Association, which was a fictitious name used by some of the affiliates of CMC, was sufficient to create a misnomer, and the court let the case go on that. I thought the case was going to get thrown out on that basis.
And so why didn't you, at that point, under your perspective, amend your response of pleadings and say, look, if we're going in this direction, I need to lay on the table that I'm going to seek fees at the end of the case?
Because I was afraid... But I thought I had a better issue on appeal if I lost that than if I got into the area where maybe I was approbating and reprobating, and I didn't want to go there. I don't think I could go there.
You can't argue in the alternative?
I don't think on that basis, no. If I was the plaintiff, I think maybe I could have. As a defendant, I don't think I could have.
You can't say in response to a contract claim, look, the contract doesn't govern me. And if it does, I still win. That's not something you can do under our procedural law?
I don't think of the way this case was fashioned that was a viable position that I could take.
And explain again, once the court ruled against you, that this party was a fictitious name, why didn't you amend your pleading to request attorney's fees under the contract?
Because I still didn't believe that our cause of action had accrued under this, was still a one-sided contract, irrespective of whether you considered the plaintiff to be just a misnomer.
Is this a cause of action? Is this a cause of action or just a defense or a claim for money in response to the, you know?
It's more like notice.
I think it's a
damage
provision for a breach of contract if it happens going forward, which is why 8.01230 creates when a cause of action accrues. And here, the cause of action didn't accrue. Until
she has a freestanding cause of action for attorney's fees that's triggered by a failed breach of contract claim by the other side.
Let's assume, let me answer it this way. Let's assume that I file a claim for prevailing party attorney's fees. The other side files a demurrer and says you haven't alleged the basis, which is one of the requirements of Rule 325. I give the basis of it, and I have no factual basis.
Shouldn't the basis be the contract?
The basis would be the contract.
What is the factual basis? I don't think you can just say...
The factual basis would be whatever your defense is to the allegation and the complaint.
I think the basis has to be that there has been a breach of contract, I have prevailed, and therefore... I can go forward, and I don't think I could do that stage of the pleading.
It's a breach of contract, and I'm going to prevail. Just like a plaintiff saying, he breached the contract, I'm going to prevail at the end, and therefore I get fees at the end.
They were not yet in breach of contract. They could only become in breach of contract after the case was over, and I made a demand upon them for payment, and they refused.
But
that's when my cause of action accrued under 8.01230.
But under that logic, the plaintiff can't be required to do a 325 notice because until the plaintiff prevails, there's no accrual under your analysis.
What clause of the contract did they breach?
They didn't. That's the problem. That's the problem.
That's the problem with your argument.
We could not claim that they breached the contract until... That case was over.
Okay, now the case is over. What part of the contract did they breach?
The prevailing party.
Did they not pay her? Did they?
They did not pay her.
I mean,
we made the demand on them.
No. I mean, you have the contract. They said she breached. Okay.
Correct.
They lost. What part of this contract did they breach vis-a-vis your client?
As I understand it, you're saying you thereafter filed a separate standing action for attorney's fees.
Correct.
They failed to pay, and that was the breach.
Correct.
Okay. All right. That's a...
Well, tell me how you read 325. Did we just write a rule that just makes no sense? Or how do you interpret what we're telling you to do in 325?
I think 325 is problematic. I think there's a tension between it and 8.01380. And I think I'm convinced that the law 8.01380 prevails where there is a tension, where there is a discrepancy. And 8.01380 says I don't have a right of action or a cause of action until this, and this happens. 325 says we don't really care whether anybody is in breach. If you want attorney's fees, you have to, one, make a demand. Two, you have to make a claim.
A demand and a claim in your mind being two separate things. So the demand and my responsive pleading saying, and if I prevail, I'm going to seek my attorney's fees.
I think 325 uses the different terms, claim and demand, and they must mean different things within the context of the rule. So, yes, I agree with you that, there's a problem with that. But the big thing here...
No, you don't. I'm not agreeing with you that there's a problem with that.
All right. I think the Supreme Court at some point needs to address the issue. I think the...
Well, our judicial counsel, which presented this to us after a full vetting by the Boyd Graves Conference, gave us a report that we read, and we read it and published it, and it clearly identifies exactly the meaning of this ruling. Am I right or wrong on that? You have to...
I don't think that they could have envisioned this particular situation, but I'd point out to the court at the same time, the Boyd Graves Convention said to you we ought to have compulsory counterclaims, and this court rejected that, and yet 325 does exactly the same thing, but does it in a different kind of way.
Has he answered your question, Justice
Kelsey?
All right, your time has expired. I think the justices had a lot to do with eating up the rebuttal, but that's just the way it happens sometimes.
Was it that my entire 15 minutes was gone?
No, you're 29 seconds over.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, John Thomas on behalf of Community Management Corporation, the appellee, with me today is Robert Lofton. Rule 325 could not be more clear. The rule required my client, CMC, as the plaintiff in the underlying case, to put Ms. Graham simply on notice that if CMC were to be declared the prevailing party at the end of the case, CMC would be seeking its attorney's fees. CMC did so, as required by subsection B of the rule, by placing an express notice provision in its complaint. In fact, CMC hired and disclosed an expert witness on the reasonableness of CMC's fees and successfully moved, pursuant to subsection D, to have the determination of CMC's fees bifurcated from the liability phase at trial. The exact same rule required Ms. Graham to place CMC on reciprocal notice if she intended to seek her fees in the event she were to declare the prevailing party. Subsection B required her to do so in her response of pleading, of which she filed five of them. In fact, her last response
of pleading... So, but let's get to the nub of the matter, which is there any tension? I mean, the rule is clear. I don't think there's any ambiguity there. He says, though, the problem isn't the rule as written, if I understand the argument. It's the tension with the statutory provision that deals with accrual of a cause of action. So can you address whether there is such a tension, and if so, how can we reconcile?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no tension with the statutory, the statute that discusses the accrual of cause of action. Because in this case, there was no accrual of an action because Ms. Graham had waived it. Whether a claim of action for a breach of contract may accrue at some future point in time is of no moment in this case because subsection C of the rule contemplates the notion of waiver. At the moment she filed her response of pleadings and declined, a tactical decision, I might add, declined to invoke the remedies of the contract, that triggered waiver. If any cause of action may accrue at some point in the future, that didn't happen in this case because she had waived it.
Can I interrupt you there? You know, I question whether waiver is the way to think about this, because if accrual were relevant at all, if it conceptually, if it played a role in whether or not the court can, by its rulemaking authority, require notices to be given in litigation or not, then the same logic would mean that the plaintiff on a prevailing party case, prevailing party fee case, we can't require the plaintiff to either, because that accrues only when they prevail at the end of the case. So the accrual argument, to me, proves too much.
That's right. To follow appellant's argument, the rule must apply both to plaintiffs and defendants alike.
Then why is waiver part of the discussion? I'm not following that.
I think that there are many different ways to slice the end result here, one of which is...
Can I just Judge, you're saying if a plaintiff did not put in their complaint that they want attorney's fees, it would be waived.
Yes,
so the same thing is true for a defendant who doesn't do it in a responsive plea.
That's correct.
So that's his waiver.
Isn't that what the rule says? I mean, doesn't the rule provide a waiver in C? Let me ask the question, and maybe it will help me understand the other argument. With the notice in your complaint, when did your cause of action for fees accrue? I'm trying to understand the accrual argument. When, once one has put the notice in the demand, when does the cause of action accrue?
Subsection D of the rule explains that it is up to the trial court and the parties to set up a mechanism by which the determination of fees is addressed.
Well, that's to determine what the fees are. When does the cause of action for the fees accrue?
So subsection D says that the trial court can bifurcate the determination of fees, meaning maybe it's after the jury returns with its verdict, maybe it's part of the prima facie case of the plaintiff's case or the defendant's case. That's not addressed specifically by the rule. In this case, plaintiff never had a claim for fees because plaintiff lost at trial.
No, her question is, when did it accrue? In other words, when did the plaintiff have an absolute right to say, all right, I want my money now? And isn't the answer, it didn't accrue at the start of the case because it's not prevailing. It only accrues when the party is deemed a prevailing party.
That is correct. We did not have a cause. The plaintiff does not have a cause of action to receive prevailing party fees until it's the prevailing party.
And yet we require the plaintiff to put the defendant on notice.
On notice, that is
okay.
Correct.
This so is the only question is, can we do that?
I think so, Your Honor. I analogized Rule 325, and the Judicial Council of Virginia did as well when it drafted Rule 325 by reference to Rule 321, the requirement that parties place notices in their pleadings for a jury demand. The rule is explicitly modeled after Rule 321 and explains a failure by a plaintiff or a defendant to put a simple one-sentence jury demand in a complaint or a responsive pleading results in waiver.
And what is your response to his argument that we have somehow violated the prohibition against compulsory counterclaims?
Rule 325 does not create compulsory counterclaims, and there's no authority to support appellant's argument. To the contrary, the text of the rule, subsection B, contemplates that a defendant may file a counterclaim. If the defendant does so, the defendant must put the plaintiff on notice in that counterclaim of defendant's intent to seek fees. If, and this is expressly illustrated by the Judicial Council of Virginia's report on draft Rule 325, if the defendant does not file a counterclaim, Rule 3:8 does require the defendant to file a responsive pleading. And all that is required is not a counterclaim for fees, but merely placing the plaintiff on notice of its intent to seek fees.
Well, suppose for the sake of argument that we said what the appellant in this case says we said, which is there's now a counterclaim in Virginia for fees. We didn't say that, but suppose we had. What statute or what constitutional provision or what case law precludes us from saying that?
None, Your Honor. Only Rule 3.9, I believe it is, which is just a rule of this court, declares that counterclaims are permissive and not compulsory.
So what difference does it make what label you throw on it? We did what we did, and we had the authority to do it.
That is correct, Your Honor. I think that the point that I thought I was addressing to your question was that this isn't the court that is somehow circumventing a rule enacted or a statute enacted by the General Assembly. To the extent that Rule 325 might be in tension with something, it's not a statute of the General Assembly, but another rule of this court, a rule which came years after Rule 3.9 was enacted and which is expressly more clear in the question pertaining to attorney's fees.
Counsel, you referred to this as a cause of action for attorney fees. Justice McCullough asked your opposing counsel about that earlier. Do you take the position it's a cause of action for attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor. If I use that language, it's because the way that appellant tried to set this case up as a second breach of contract. It sort of has turned into that. But the way the rule contemplates how attorney's fees are to be addressed, there's no cause of action for fees. Rule 325 requires notice and for the trial court in subsection D to address how and when the determination of fees is addressed. So I don't think technically it's a cause of action for fees that accrues. Most cases that we've cited in our briefs, what the parties do is they simply file a motion after the prevailing party is declared for fees. It's not a separate cause of action. I'd like to address the fact that Ms. Graham is claiming fees is a classic example of her approbating and reprobating. Throughout the entirety of the litigation, through five responsive pleadings and through trial, she made the exclusive and unconditional point that not only was the 2007 confidentiality agreement void, but the attorney's fees provision itself had been superseded by a later contract. And her claim today is, to use the language of the court, is nothing more than her speaking out of both sides of her mouth and not placing the court or the plaintiff on proper notice of her claims. She had the absolute right and, in fact, the duty, I think, to plead in the alternative, which the cases make clear she was permitted to do.
Was that approbating or reprobating or just a tactical decision that didn't pan out?
That's right. The tactical decision, the cases make clear that a defendant is permitted to plead in the alternative, even if they're polar opposites. You can say a contract is invalid, but if the court disagrees with me, then I'm entitled to the remedies under that contract. In this case, no such election was made, and instead, it was a tactical decision that appears to be a flawed one to claim only that the contract was superseded. Unless the court has any additional questions, I will yield back the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.